Good afternoon. The House Transportation and Regional Governance Policy Committee will come to order. And we do have a quorum, I believe. Okay. So, Representative Barr, would you make a motion, please, to approve the minutes, February 8th meeting?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the minutes be approved from the February 8th meeting.
Very good. Representative Barr moves approval of the minutes from February 8th meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the minutes of February 8th are approved. Okay, members, we have a slight change in our order today. I believe Representative Howe has another place to be. So, Representative Howe, I will move your bill, House File 326, and we'll re-refer that to the Committee on Transportation Finance. So, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Committee. House File 326, what it does is designates a portion of Highway 23 in the city and the surrounding town of Painesville as the Medal of Honor recipient Kenneth L. Olson Highway. What I'd like to do is just read you a little bit about what Kenneth Olson did for his country. Ken Olson was the first. In June of 67, Ken Olson was the first of his family to graduate from the University of Minnesota. In fact, the only one in his first one in his family to graduate from college. And he was going to go to Purdue to get his graduate degree, but when the Meeker County draft board informed him that his student deferment wouldn't be extended. Arrived in Vietnam April 1st of 68. 6 weeks later, on May 13th, 68, his unit was reinforcing a platoon that was engaged by an entrenched Viet Cong force. Specialist Fort Olson and a fellow soldier moved forward of the platoon to investigate another suspected line of bunkers. As the two men advanced, they were pinned down by intense automatic weapons fire from an enemy position 10 miles to their front. With complete disregard for his own safety, Specialist Olson exposed himself and hurled a hand grenade into the Viet Cong position. Failing to silence the fire, he again exposed himself to the intense fire in preparation to assault the position. As he prepared to hurl a hand grenade, he was wounded. He dropped the grenade within his own position. Realizing that it would explode immediately, Specialist Olson threw himself upon the grenade, pulled it into his body to take the full force of the explosion. By taking the full force of the grenade, Olson saved the life of Gary Lindley, the fellow soldier who had advanced with him to that forward position. In April of 1970, President Nixon presented the Congressional Medal of Honor to Ken's family. Ken Olson is the only Painesville High School graduate to earn the Congressional Medal of Honor. He is the only University of Minnesota graduate to earn the Medal of Honor during the Vietnam War. So that's what it's all about. It's to honor a true hero of this country.
Right.
With that, I'll stand for any questions.
And so I take it, Representative, that there are no further testifiers to the bill. Is that correct?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Any questions of the committee? From the committee, I should say. Okay. Well, I think it's wonderful that the city of Painesville, has come forward to do this. It's fantastic. So.
Yes, Madam Chair. In fact, his nephew, I believe it's his nephew, works here. Well, he was working at Cedar Street Armory just down the street, but he was not in town to come here. Otherwise, he would have been here to present.
Okay, very good. Well, then we'll proceed to the vote. I'll renew my motion that House File 326 be referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Okay. The motion does prevail, and House File 326 is referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance.
Thank you,
Representative.
Thank you.
Okay, next up we have Representative Raskowski and House File 465. And you are accompanied by Representative Haley. So welcome. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Haley and I have been working on this bill since actually before session started. This is a bill that's improved upon the one that we had and passed as part of the omnibus tax bill in 2015, Madam Chair. What the bill does is it provides, and I'll walk through it quickly here, Section 1.
And Representative, I'll just move the bill for you. So,
thank you.
I have not done that. So please proceed.
Thank you. So Section 1 provides that there's no state government spending on Zip Rail. Section 2 provides that if there's any property that's leased for a Zip Rail, that there is a security bond set aside in order to put the properties of the state back together again, that should the Zip Rail fail. Section 3 provides that eminent domain cannot be used to build a Zip Rail. Section 4 provides that project proceeds for Zip Rail, that environmental insurance is provided, so that if there are some potential environmental damages, that those would be covered. Section 5 provides no local government spending for Zip Rail, and then Section 6 is similar around the Metropolitan Council and that it can't spend money on Zip Rail. Madam Chair, members, this is a bill that's a good bill to provide good government so that we don't have additional recreational spending of state and local resources that provide for long-term perpetual liabilities for the people of Minnesota. So that's the motivation behind the bill, and I know Representative Haley's got some comments as well.
Okay, Representative Haley, please proceed.
Just a few short comments. Again, I represent 21A, which includes the citizens of Cannon Falls, and many of the residents have been very concerned about this project, particularly the lack of transparency as this project has been kind of on again, off again. And so this bill is an important protection for those citizens' land rights, as Representative Draskowski said, to make sure that the no eminent domain rules can be put into place, which would take their farmland. And it also protects not only the citizens of Cannon Falls, but all of us, frankly, in the state of Minnesota, from taxpayer dollars being spent on a project that, at this point, is ill-conceived and would leave us, I think, on the hook for money if it started to be built and wasn't able to be completed. To my knowledge, there hasn't been a high-speed rail project like this anywhere in the world that was completed without significant public investment. So I am in support of moving this bill forward, and I'll leave the rest to our testifiers today.
Okay, very good. So, yes, your testifiers, if you'd please come forward, and we welcome you to the committee. And please introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed.
My name is Nora Felton, and I want to thank the chairman and the committee for hearing my testimony today. My family farms in Goodhue in Dakota County, where my husband and I have spent over 20 years carefully and with great financial risk piecing together 2,800 acres without the state doing any of it for us via eminent domain. We are also co-owners of the Great Western Industrial Park in Randolph, Minnesota, which relies on freight rail. Today, I'm here to speak in support of HF 465. Representative Draskowski's legislation is needed to protect Minnesota taxpayers, property owners, and our environment from a proposed high-speed rail project between the Twin Cities and Rochester, a.k.a. the Zip Rail, and to hold its private investors accountable to their no public funds claim. Further, HF 465 is needed to, as Dr. Levinson stated in his testimony to you last week, to, quote, preserve and protect our right-of-way. And as Randall O'Toole suggested, it's needed so that we're using our infrastructure efficiently and effectively to move the greatest amount of passengers and freight, thereby ensuring this agricultural corridor is kept for its highest and best use, which is providing food security and the biodiversity that helps save the planet and continues to be the means that moves our commerce to market. HF 465 protects Minnesota taxpayers and property owners by denying any further spending on this elitist travel alternative and the massive land grab it intends to use to get federal and state transit-oriented development funding, which, by the way, is still taxpayer money. Minnesota taxpayers have already paid to study this corridor four times, five if you're an Olmsted County resident, at the cost of about $3 million each time. There has never been any proof of need. Indeed, there has never been any proof that it should be included in the 2015 state rail plan as a Tier 1 corridor. See the attached comments to this, please, at the end. Highway 52 is what Dr. Levinson would classify as underused most of the time with plenty of extra capacity during the off-peak. No cost-benefit analysis has ever been performed on this corridor. No cost estimates ever changed despite moving the project from ground to concrete piers placed a fourth of a mile apart. The project will not service the people living within the corridor and thereby falling short of Livingston's policy recommendation that the focus should be on projects that most effectively expand accessibility for all, which is efficiency, or for those with fewer opportunities, addressing equality. The investment should exploit what has already been built. The project's technical advisory committee and the community advisory committee both failed and were disbanded. Yet it remains on the Tier 1 funding request that you recently received from the Minnesota DOT. This madness must end. Further, if the state takes property via eminent domain to give to a private zip rail investor, it inserts itself into the transaction by signing the purchase agreement, and that will inadvertently put taxpayers on the hook for the whole project for perpetuity, just as accepting federal funding for the North Star has, though in a different manner. Such a use of eminent domain also sets a dangerous precedent for allowing the party in power to directly usurp private real property as a means of political payback. HF 465 will protect both Minnesota taxpayers and property owners and will not allow the unintended consequences of state overreach. If a private investor wants to build a high-speed rail, it should be no different than wanting to purchase your neighbor's farm. HF 465 ensures that our water supply and environment is protected by requiring a security bond. The proposed zip rail corridor lies in a karst region highly susceptible to sinkholes and water contamination, such as happened to wells within a 12-mile radius where a Chinese rail pier sunk just a few inches. HF 465 protects and preserves our right-of-way. It ensures that the air rights above will not be leased out through some secret memorandum of understanding with the DOT as attempted last spring. As Dr. Levinson noted in his presentation, the value, the benefits, costs of preserving existing links is far greater than the value of new links serving future speculative developments and TOD, transit-oriented development. Lastly, HF 465 ensures this agricultural corridor is kept for its highest and best use. It is not merely some barren greenfield. It is a vibrant economy providing food security and the biodiversity that helps save the planet. My daughter's FFA t-shirt says it all. You need a lawyer once in your lifetime, a dentist once a year, but you need a farmer three times a day. The state rail plan speaks of decreasing farmland and a growing demand for agricultural goods. Minnesota's already lost some 900,000 acres of farmland between 2010 and 2012. Another 100,000 will be lost to the governor's buffer strip confiscation. With the world's population expected to be at 9 billion by 2050, producing enough food is our constant challenge. Two sets of tracks destroying 80 miles of rural greenfield calculates out to about 6,600 acres of what the FS Farm Service Agency maps considered prime cropland that will permanently be taken out of production. Food is a matter of national security. According to the Minnesota DOT's 2015 state rail plan, Minnesota is the fourth largest producer of corn in the United States. We export $6.5 billion in agriculture commodities plus another $1.6 billion in manufactured food exports. Southeast Minnesota farmland produces two-thirds of all Minnesota produce, and it is considered a primary asset. All those figures come from the Minnesota DOT's own state rail plan. The corridor has three processors and food processors, or excuse me, vegetable processors, and at least five seed stock companies. Three of these have research facilities, meaning we already have a biotech corridor. Based on $3.50 corn, which we haven't seen for a while, the proposed zip rail would cost the corridor $4.62 million annually. Agriculture within the proposed corridor is one of the most diverse in the nation because we have and grow snap beans, sweet corn, snap beans, seed corn, hay seed, soybeans, food grade soybeans, field corn, wheat, and soybeans. Many of them are double cropped. We are at the face of locally grown food and protein. Even with a raised track, the buttresses leave a huge footprint that will cut off my irrigators, destroying the niche markets and contract relationships that have taken decades to develop. Agriculture within the proposed corridor helps save the planet. We nourish and sustain populations with our safe, economical food production, feeding the most people on the fewest acres to keep the world's rainforest safe. We mop up your CO2 and hold back and absorb your water so your aquifers can recharge. The economic value we bring to the state, the nation, the world, rivals anything the DMC or Zip Rail could ever contribute, and we do it all with our own vibrant economic development plan that is passing our farms on to the next generation. Thank you for considering my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Felton. Could you just describe for us how wide the corridor is and where it is in relation to Highway 52? I don't think I've seen anything on that.
The corridor continues to move. Originally, it was told to everyone that it would be within the 52, with it between the lanes, and obviously it doesn't fit there going 200 miles an hour. Indeed, it won't fit even going alongside it and staying within the right-of-way. It could actually be, when you get down to all of their reports, anywhere from a mile east of Highway 52 to a mile west of Highway 56. And we are told all the time that corridors do change.
All right, thank you. Sir, are you testifying today too?
Yep.
Okay, and please give us your name for the record.
My name is John Meyer. I'm a resident of Olmsted County. There has never been a proven need for this line. The assessment that was done, alternatives analysis, the stated need in there leading into that was stated that there is a need for another alternative mode between Minneapolis and Rochester. That's a predetermined conclusion, and therefore the alternatives analysis only included rail alternatives. That's all they studied. There's never been an alternatives analysis that included all modes of transportation. Let's see which one of these fits the corridor best, which one can be done the most economically and serve the most people. So is the conclusion that came out of that analysis any surprise to anybody? We're going to have another rail, right? That's the way they approached it. The corridor is Highway 52. It's a four-lane expressway, rural expressway. It runs at 47% of as-designed capacity currently. If we improve that corridor to full-on freeway status, that would nearly double the capacity, and we're at 47% as-designed right now. It clearly would be a huge safety improvement because you'd eliminate all those highways that cross that corridor. So that's critical that we upgrade that, or in the future that will have to happen, regardless of what we do as far as rail transit. Passenger rail transit has a proven track record of only being able to capture about 5% of the traffic that's in any given corridor anyway. So would it address the needs of the capacity needs of the highway? No. The highway also has to address freight needs. It's a huge freight transportation corridor. And as the population increases and commuters, all that kind of thing, those people are what generates the need for the freight. So that transportation corridor of Highway 52 is still going to have to be upgraded, regardless of whether we take 5% of the passenger travel off of it or not, right? As many of you know, Southeast Minnesota has been trying really hard to find the funding to complete that deadly Highway 14 corridor between Mankato and Rochester. Never can come up with it. Well, what happens if we start siphoning off dollars, transportation dollars, to support something like a zip rail between Rochester and Minneapolis that's going to carry 5% of passenger traffic, you know, on its wildest dreams? Why is this happening? Because we've got what goes on, I'll call Bader funding. We don't want to say no to anybody, so we slip them a few dollars here and there to try and keep this thing going. They're happy with it because it kept it alive. You know, it's life support, but it's just not ever going to see the light of day and complete it. Why are we siphoning off these millions to these places? Why aren't we questioning that? Why aren't we determining first? Don't we need to figure out what direction we want to go before we start funding all these other kinds of projects? I think that would just make sense. We've already wasted many years and millions of dollars trying to push this thing forward, and here we sit now with it kind of almost in a dead wake. That's why it's being called, you look at the signs along Highway 52, zombie rail. Just kind of keeps coming back from the dead because that Bader funding keeps slipping out somehow to it and gets revived again. In the late 90s through the early 2000s, Rochester and the Mayo Clinic had another rail project that they were pushing. That was the freight rail bypass, and some of you who have been around here a while are familiar with it. Never was a needs study done on that was objective either, and money was siphoning out for that process. Finally, we as citizens were able to push that process to where MnDOT finally did an alternatives analysis that was objective, that did include a no build, that included, let's see what we can do on the existing route. In the end, that analysis in 2013, after 15 years of wrangling over this and tearing community apart, the results of that came out and said incremental improvements on the existing route are the best way to handle any of the needs for this freight rail system. Interesting to note, after 15 years of wrangling and Olmsted County and Mayo Clinic tearing the community apart with all the opposition, they haven't pursued a single one of those improvements that they suggested, one of them being you should move the siding that's in downtown Rochester outside of the city. DM&E would have gone in on this with them, so there would have been shared costs to do it. Haven't pursued it at all. Didn't pursue rezoning so that people can't encroach onto that right away through town. So how serious were they that was a huge safety threat? Now let's fast forward, or dual corridor almost, or dual at the same time. They shifted their focus to this zip rail thing, didn't they? You don't hear anything about the freight rail bypass anymore. You don't hear anything that it was even, those results came from DOT. They shifted their attention to the zip rail. And now we've got the same process going on again. No needs analysis done ahead of time. Bader funding keeps coming out to it. It has been. Public dollars siphoning out to it. And they continue to keep it alive. This bill is needed to put an end to that kind of a process. No public funding for zip rail, period. We know that Highway 52 has the capacity, when you look at DOT's projections, out to 2040, as designed right now, without full-on freeway status, has the capacity to cover all of the needs that they anticipate happening. We don't even have to upgrade it to full freeway status. I think that should happen. I think that should also happen to Highway 14. Those are where our priorities need to be. House File 465 is important. We need this bill. I ask for your support.
Thank you. Is there any discussion from the committee on the bill? Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious for the other testifier. You said there was four studies, or five if you count study A or whatever it was. just wondering what the cost has been since its first inception or idea on studies, both locally, local government entities, and then if any state.
Ms. Felton? Please go through the chair, Ms. Felton.
I am not certain what the local cost would be to Olmsted County, as I'm not a resident of Olmsted, but on average, they are about $2.5 to $3 million per study each time.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Long? Representative Drozdowski, do you have those numbers? Can you substantiate hers or not?
I'm from Olmsted County. I don't have the exact numbers, but there's been significant significant cost incurred on the local level as this thing moved forward, and then the state level got involved through the passenger rail forum. There was $26 million that went out through bonding, general obligation bonds, to the passenger rail forum, and they were allocated some money there. That's an unelected body of interested parties in the passenger rail forum. They all have their own dog in the race, and they decide between themselves who's going to get the money. That's this Bader funding that I'm talking about. No accountability.
Madam
Representative McDonald.
Oh, so we got, what, four studies at about $2 million, $3 million per study. And for the last how many years has this been going on?
I believe the first one was in...
Please address the chair first. You just say, Madam Chair, and then you talk to your...
I'm sorry. Yeah. Madam Chair, I believe the first one was in, like, 1998, from my memory. But just speak to the point of what it's cost you. Perhaps it would be helpful to know that Minnesota Department of Transportation had to borrow from the Ramsey County Regional Rail Authority $600,000 this last year to complete the study on what is called the River Corridor, which is supposed to be the state's first priority in getting high-speed rail. And so that is still up in the air as to how and when Ramsey County will get that back. But obviously they have, I feel they have used the money in places that perhaps was not a priority if they had to borrow the $600,000 from the Regional Rail Authority in Ramsey County.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks. I just have a couple of questions for the author, if that's okay. Are we at that section of the
hearing? Please go ahead.
Okay. At the end, on the effective date and application, this is lines 4.28 to 4.30. I just want to get a sense of what... there was some confusion among some constituents of mine who've been following a lot of rail issues, as you can imagine, about the counties involved here. So, like, why is, for example, Anoka included but not Scott?
And I wonder if we would have Mr. Burris perhaps give some clarification on that.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Burris? Representative Hornstein, that's standard language for application for provisions that impact the Metropolitan Council. So this section deals with Chapter 473, which covers various provisions around local government, but also has all of the provisions laying out requirements for the Metropolitan Council. So this is kind of standard technical application language. So it doesn't specifically address the substantive impact in a given county. It's that's the area of the Metropolitan Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and then Mr. Burris. So is there a reason why Scott County isn't included?
Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, that is a technical oversight.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Representative Hornstein.
Well, so there's another Scott County-related question, and that is, I don't remember if this language was, I think it's similar, if not, but maybe not identical. There's a prohibition in law that we've been trying to undo. I've worked with Representative Beard on this. Where there was a prohibition on studying commuter rail from Northfield to the metropolitan area. And this is not high-speed rail. This is just And, you know, I think we joked about it, but there might have been even something to this that they couldn't even talk about it. So the question is, in the prohibition, I know that there's planning included, infrastructure as well, all sorts of things, but would the, for example, Olmsted County Board be prohibited from even discussing this or expending any staff resources at all, you know, period, on would that be a part of this bill? Because I think that was what was so irksome about the moratorium we put on the Northfield project. So, like, what are the boundaries? What are the limits on this?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe Mr. Burris can provide more detail or more insight into this, but certainly the intent is to not allow public money to be used for this, really, period. And so, Representative Hornstein, I mean, if the Olmsted County Board wants to talk about it, it doesn't say anything about that, but if they're going to use resources to plan or to, drive a bunch of trucks up to evaluate the corridor for it, then that would be prohibited under the language, as I understand it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, because I appreciate that and understand that there's definitely a differentiation between actual expenditures for planning and the kind of physical manifestations of this, as you talk about, infrastructure. But I'd be a little bit concerned if they couldn't even talk about it. Which I think was how, maybe Mr. Burris, I don't know if I'm exaggerating, but I think there was even some kind of in that Northfield thing, I think there was, it even went that far, perhaps.
Mm. So. Right.
Did it? I don't know. Did it?
I don't know. Did you care to comment, Mr. Burris?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, to my recollection, there was a requirement in that law that directed a removal of the line from past planning documents, and was largely centered around expenditure of funds, somewhat parallel to the language you see here in House Bill 465. I don't recall a specific prohibition on discussions overall, but planning efforts were listed among the types of activities that were prohibited for that for that line as well as this one.
And Madam Chair, just one last quick question. So just, I think you meant it's in the bill, but just it would be helpful, I guess, again, questions that have surfaced in the metro area about this. So this is not in any way related to planning for light rail and commuter rail in the metropolitan area. So it's just very much confined to the ZIP rail project itself. Is that correct?
President Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, no, it's really focused on the ZIP rail corridor, but certainly, Representative Hornstein, the author would entertain an amendment to add some more prohibitions, if you like.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sometimes, many times I've heard that when people come to the legislature, they forget where they came from, particularly when they've served on city councils. And because this is the second bill that I've heard in the past week where it's really limiting local control, I have issues as to why you would include the prohibition of local involvement, the Section 5.
Mm-hmm. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Mason, because really the proliferation of some of the types of spending that Mr. Meyer talked about have come from in the forms of local governments all across our state with these discussions. And, they are spending not only property tax dollars, but ostensibly sales and income tax dollars that are dished out in the form of local government aid and others. And so you have really this almost race to fund this nostalgic idea that saddles the taxpayer with a perpetual liability. And so that's what we're trying to avoid here. And, we're looking out for the taxpayers. And when you've got cities in different parts of the state popping up all over the place, it seems anyway, to fund their own piece of nostalgia, this is the way, at least in this corridor, that we see best to do it.
All right. Representative Koznick, did you have a follow-up? Representative Mason? Okay. Representative Kosnick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of a general question and for staff. I don't know if this is for the author, but is there a defined difference between, we're talking about zip rail, passenger rail, or light rail? Is there a difference in the weights of the vehicles moving? Is there, what might be the difference, or are we just using different terminology?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, there are differences in, I would say, common understanding in the transportation community, but not a statutory definition of each of the light rail, bus rapid transit, commuter rail, intercity passenger rail definitions. So some of the distinctions are laid out in some agency planning documents as well as in federal documents. Some of the difference deals with the weight of the vehicles, of the rolling stock, and the capacity of the rail itself, so kind of the physical infrastructure. And then there are also differences with regard to the spacing of stations and the kind of service that's provided. So intercity passenger rail typically refers to rail service between metropolitan communities as opposed to rail service within a broad, you know, sort of a single broad community such as the Twin Cities metro area.
Pasnick, follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to clarify, not a significant differences between the term passenger rail and light rail transit, other than maybe the, I guess if you can clarify, just.
Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, I would say that there are a number of differences. Obviously, it's all on rail track with, you know, trains and cars that people ride in and getting on and off at stations. But the nature of the service, the spacing between stations, the speed of operation, the kinds of station facilities are all different, kind of significant differences. If you want, I could provide the committee with a couple of examples that in some of the planning and report documents lay out some more detail behind those distinctions.
President Pasnick?
Madam Chair, thank you. Could you also, that would be a wonderful report, just or memo, also include freight rail differences in there so that we can kind of talk about those. And I guess my concern is that there is an established statute that prohibits a certain type of rail, that we don't just use different wording to circumvent the intent of that previous statute.
All right, Representative Iwakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question for the author too, Representative Skalski. I think I remember us briefly discussing this last time the bill was up. My little concern with the bill, even though I completely understand and appreciate where you're coming from, is on line 3.31 and using the words planning for, because I worry that we're handcuffing cities from planning or reacting to something that may be completely out of their control if a private entity does decide to come in and proceed with this project. Cities wouldn't even be able to plan how they were going to structure or react to it with that language in there. And that concerns me a little bit, because there's so many times where we take local control away from the folks that are supposed to be doing what's best for their own community, and this would preclude them from even planning for something that would be going right through their backyard.
Representative Ostrowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Joachim. And we did have that discussion 2 years ago, and I know that the community of Rochester was concerned that we might be limiting their ability to plan parking facilities and some other things at an area that might be a terminus to something like this. And if you look at the bill on lines 4.10 through 4.15, you'll see that there were some exceptions we wrote into the bill last year. I think we might have changed this slightly. Maybe not, but it's very similar language to what we had 2 years ago that gives some of that flexibility that might otherwise be a concern for one or more of those communities.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I did see that, but it does if I'm reading it right, maybe I'm just reading it wrong, it talks about plans that were adopted before the enactment of this section. So they would have had to plan on how they were going to react to something that hasn't even happened yet. That's on line 4.13. Or am I just not reading it right?
Perhaps Mr. Burris could give us some enlightenment on that one. Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair and members, there, as I'm reading it at the moment, I think there's a potential to read that requirement of it being reflected in development plan before this bill is enacted. That could apply just to similar projects within the area of the development district, or it could apply to any of the costs that are being enumerated in that Clause 2 list. So there might be some possibility for clarifying whether the intent there is to just be narrowly focused to development plans that have already been put into effect.
Representative, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to point that out, Representative Drzkowski, I hope you will continue to look at that language and make sure, because 10 years from now, a private entity could come in and fund this, and then cities would be stuck with not being able to plan or do anything to counteract what was happening. So okay. Just a thought.
Mm-hmm. And Representative, if you just, we want to hear one more thought here from Mr. Burris. So.
Madam Chair and Representative Joachim, sorry, one other thing I'd like to note with that is that listing is an including, so you know, in general that's usually read as a set of examples that provide some, you know, intended to provide not necessarily a comprehensive list, but some guideposts to the overall intent. So I think the key operative language is really at the beginning, the expenditures for costs of public infrastructure, which is quite broad. And then following that is really a listing of some of the examples of types of expenditures that could be covered under planning efforts.
Okay. Representative Joachim.
Madam Chair, one quick thing. Yes, sometimes I can understand where we write it broad just in case, but sometimes those cases end up in court because of that. So I would still like the representative to keep looking at that. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Anderson? Carlson?
Well, you got the...
I know, Andrew. Yep. Got it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the author. And again, thank you to the testifiers today for providing a pretty detailed background with the history of this project. I appreciate that. And I appreciate and understand your opposition to this. My question, though, is, as of last year, it looks as if, well, it appears to be where the Olmsted County Regional Rail Authority and MnDOT suspended this project, and that as of right now, the North American High-Speed Rail Group is no longer pursuing the project. So it appears to be essentially dead. So my question is all of this even necessary, despite that this project in the foreseeable future is going nowhere?
Representative Drzkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, if Representative Carlson, if you could provide that guarantee to the people in our district and throughout Minnesota that may end up with this perpetual liability strapped on their backs, you know, we could go without the bill. But if we want to be certain that this rather insane idea doesn't happen, this is a way to do it.
Representative Carlson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Drzkowski. I guess where we would probably have to disagree is that, I believe that as times change and neither one of us can predict the future, these types of preemptive legislation, we have one hand tied behind the back. In this case, we'd have both hands tied behind the back our backs to address unforeseeable types of situations. And again, allowing for that ability to even to speak to and address these types of concerns seems to me would be prudent. So I guess that's just a fundamental disagreement in terms of how we're viewing this. So thank you.
Representative Drzkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I understand, Madam Chair, members, that this is still in the state rail plan as one of their Tier 1 priorities. So there you have it.
And Representative Carlson, we'll certainly be looking at this in the Finance Committee and have a better chance to ask and get answers to that kind of a question. So,
thank you.
Thank you. All right. Are there any folks in the audience who wish to testify on the bill? Okay, seeing none. Right. And we're going to take care of a little faux pas here in the with an amendment. So I'm going to move to amend, and it's just a technical amendment, House File 465, as follows. Page 4, line 29, after Ramsey, insert Scott. Is there any discussion on that? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, amendment prevails. All right, I will renew the motion to re-refer House File 465 to the Committee on Taxes. And all those in favor signify by? As amended, absolutely. 465 as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And the same sign?
No.
For those opposed?
No.
Okay. The bill prevails, and the bill moves on to Tax Committee. Thank you, Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good questions and good hope. Thank you, Representative Joaquin.
Madam Chair?
And Representative Horn.
Which committee was this being referred to?
Taxes.
Taxes, yes. Not Transportation Finance?
Okay. Apparently, Chair Davids has requested the bill in taxes.
Okay, thank you.
So next stop.
I thought I heard called.
Okay. So, Madam Chair.
President Bernardi.
So it's the 10th for it to go to Transportation Finance after that?
Yes, that's certainly my expectation. So, all right. Next up, we have Representative Halverson and House File. What is it here? House File 455. So welcome, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please tell us about your bill. I should first of all, I'm going to make a motion to move it. And we'll refer it to the Committee on Transportation Finance. I'm sorry, it's going to the General Register. Okay, House File 455 is going to be re-referred to the General Register. So welcome, and please proceed, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you made my first point about this bill. There's no fiscal note. So it does get to hopefully go advance to the General Register if the committee so chooses. This is a bill that many of you heard last year. It did pass the Transportation Policy Committee unanimously last year and was calendared, and on the last day we didn't get to it. So I'm bringing it before you again. Thank you for hearing it. This was is one of my favorite kinds of bills in that it was brought to me by some citizens of my district who had some concerns about what they found out was rules in the public safety sector on how school buses can operate in right turn lanes. There are a few communities that choose, for their very own reasons, to have school buses stop in right-hand turn lanes. And public safety rules actually stated that buses were not allowed to use their stop arms and flashing lights in those right-hand turn lanes. And what my constituents had discovered, and you'll see the second page of the handout there shows a map, that what was happening was that cars were assuming that the bus was not stopped to load and unload students or load students, and they were going around the bus and putting those students at risk. And at this particular intersection, what was happening in my district, there's about six different ways that a kid could get hit by a car in this situation. And so we worked on language with a number of entities to essentially take the rule that was prohibiting that and put it in statute that it would, in fact, the bus driver should default to using the flashing lights and stop arms that signal to all of us that children are going to be getting on or off a bus, unless a district, for their own reason, decides that it proposes a more serious danger. So we do allow local control to continue, but we want them to default. And there is one small technical amendment that is in your packet to this bill that just clarifies language.
Right, Representative Halverson, I will move the A1 amendment to House File 455 to get it in the shape that you prefer. Is there any discussion to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will just let the committee know that this is technical language to just further clarify that we're talking about right-hand turn lane bus stops, and this was brought to me by the Department of Public Safety, and Lieutenant Rue is here if folks have any questions about the bill or the amendment.
Does anyone want to hear from the lieutenant? We could probably just have him come down and say a quick word. I know that is it State Patrol is supporting the bill? Is that right? Okay.
Madam Chair, yes.
All right. Welcome, sir, and give us your name for the record and your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Lieutenant Brian Drew with the Minnesota State Patrol, specifically with the Office of People Transportation Safety.
Very good. Please proceed with your comments.
This is a bill that is not necessarily an agency initiative, but we have worked closely with both authors to monitor it and to get it in the language that we are comfortable with. And that was the intent of the amendment, just to reiterate or clarify that we're talking specifically about the right turn lane stops and that the bus must stop where there is a right turn lane in that specific lane.
Very good. All right. So I don't see any questions. We'll proceed to the vote. All those in favor signify. Oh, Representative Petersburg.
You're voting on the amendment?
On the amendment, yes. Mm-hmm. All those in favor of the A1 amendment to House File 455, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. All right, did you, I think there's another amendment, and did you wish to bring that to the committee then, Representative Halverson, or is that someone else's amendment? Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Very good. Representative McDonald moves the A2. Do you want to describe that for us, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This particular amendment would allow the school bus to be able to pull over on a bicycle lane when picking up or discharging children. Currently, under Representative Halverson's bill, this would not be allowed. I spoke to the author, and she is agreeable that this would be a good amendment to her bill, and therefore I have her blessing, and that is what the amendment does. It allows the school buses to be able to pull over in a bicycle lane on the right side to pick up or discharge school children.
Hmm. Did you want to comment on that, Representative Halverson?
Madam Chair, I would say I would consider this a friendly amendment, and I understand that the amendment author has talked to a number of the stakeholders, including bus operators and the Department of Public Safety and others and cyclists who agree that this will further enhance student safety. So I would certainly consider this a friendly amendment and support it.
Very good. Any questions, members? Representative McDonald.
Yeah, just I want to give a shout out to my good friends, the Burnicks, Jay and Ramey Burnick, who owns Stalky Bus in Delano, and good friends of mine they keep me abreast on all the bus issues and help me determine on this amendment as well.
Very good. Okay. All right. So the A2 amendment to House File 455, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. The A2 amendment is adopted. All right. Anything else then? Any questions? Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to either the testifier or the author of the bill. As a past school bus driver myself, and understanding the differences between just the ambers and the four-way flashes, when you get into this type of situation and you have the four-way flashers on, in most cases that indicates that all people stop, including oncoming traffic, that are, many lanes over from that. Is that still the case here, and does that create a little bit more of a traffic incident issue or not?
Representative Halverson, a little background on bus stopping these days.
Madam Chair, I might ask for the State Patrol to comment on this. I will comment that as they're coming down as a driver, when I see the flashing yellows or the flashing reds, whether or not I'm stopping. So if I'm seeing the flashing ambers, I know to be looking for students, and that is certainly the intention. In terms of how it affects the rest of traffic, mm-hmm. But I would defer to the testifiers.
Sir, if you can enlighten us a bit, we would be very gracious.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Lieutenant Brian Rugan with the State Patrol. When the bus is stopping with the four-way flashers, other motorists would not be required to stop. That's just your hazard warning lights. When the red lights are on, that is when traffic is required to stop. there are certain circumstances or incidents where some of the local jurisdictions, like that representative talked about, the local control determined it may be safer for traffic flow to allow a bus to stop without activating the red lights and stop arms so traffic can keep flowing to reduce the congestion if the children run across the road.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you very much for that clarification. That's kind of what I was anticipating, giving the option to the school districts to make that decision. But in all reality, if this does pass and the school district doesn't say anything, if they stop in the right-hand lane and there are right-hand lane plus two additional lanes plus three lanes on the other side or so, all traffic from all directions would be required to stop in that particular case, according to this law. Is that correct?
Lieutenant?
Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg and other members, that is correct. If they were using the eight-way lights, the flashing red lights and stop arm, all traffic would have to stop unless it's on a divided highway.
I'm just going to make a comment myself. I guess I wasn't aware that school districts, you know, could actually sort of set some of the rules themselves, and that seems like right there you'd have the beginning of confusion, which I guess that's for another day, but it doesn't seem like that totally makes sense. But perhaps you've seen it differently. Do you have a comment on that, sir?
Madam Chair, I would just say that that allowance is currently in the statute, that they can do that with designated bus stops. They are under the direction of the Director of People Transportation for each school district to set the stops, and then each stop is approved by the school board. So there are some oversight from the local control to determine what is the best appropriate stop for their location, and based on traffic patterns and flows and needs for the district.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kosnick, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier here, if the buses stop in the right-hand turn lane, must the bus then, after the children are off the bus, take a right, or must they go straight?
Lieutenant?
Madam Chair, Representative, they would be allowed to re-enter traffic, deactivate the eight-ways by shutting the door, signal back into the normal through line of traffic and proceed when it was clear to do so.
Representative?
Madam Chair, is a regular automobile in the right-hand turn lane, are they permitted to go directly through the intersection and re-enter the straightaway then as well, or is this separate for busing then?
Lieutenant?
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess you bring up a good point. If it would say right turn only, then they should proceed with making that right turn.
Representative?
Madam Chair, thank you. So clarify what you just said, because first you said that the bus can re-enter to go straight in that intersection, and then you said they can take a right. Can you clarify what the correct answer will be then?
Lieutenant.
If it's a designated right turn only lane, then they would have to abide by the regulatory signs, which would say right turn only. So the bus should proceed with making that right turn.
Okay.
Representative?
Madam Chair?
Good.
Can somebody provide testimony how this would impact the bus drivers and how they should know which way to operate then if the bus route is dropping off the student here on the corner, but the bus route proceeds along the prescribed right route, north and south, or straight, I guess it would be. Are they going to have drop the student off and take a right turn and then make a U-turn through the neighborhood and come back and take another right lane? Or is there somebody that can clarify that?
Lieutenant, do you want to take a stab at this? Is there...
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't see any exception to following the regulations of traffic law, which would require that the right turn be made.
Mm-hmm. Representative,
Just to follow up on this issue here, perhaps the author, if I understood it correctly, Representative Halverson, this is derived from a specific incident in your district, and could you tell the committee how it was resolved?
Madam Chair, it was resolved for this particular family. They actually changed the in terms of the bus who dropped off the student. But what it brought forward was a much bigger and more shocking issue, frankly. I remember the first time I brought this to committee, people, it was palpable, it was audible how shocked people were that you could have a bus stop in a right-hand turn lane and that cars could be turning in front of this particular bus where children were going to be coming on and off the bus. And so it is certainly much bigger than just my district. It's really about student safety. So although this one family was had a successful resolution to their issue, this family and others who have talked to me about this continue to have concerns about what it means when a bus stops. And I think that any of us who drive a car, when we see a bus stopped with flashing ambers or flashing reds, we know what's happening. We anticipate students. When we see a bus stopped, and very often I'm in one of those neighborhoods where the last students on the route are dropped off, and then the bus driver, for whatever reason, stays in the neighborhood. I don't know if they do paperwork or what, but the bus is always pulled off to the side of the road without any indication that there are students coming on and off the bus because it's stopped with no flashing lights. And so in that case, you know, we go by that bus without anticipating seeing students come off and on and off. And I think it's also important to note that the language that you see that's new in statute all comes from what is currently prescribed in the rules for public safety, except for the rule or the language regarding the flashing amber and flashing red. That's the only thing that's new in terms of what how school bus operators are currently operating in our communities.
Okay. Just one last. If my understanding is correct, that the school bus drivers associations, they don't have a problem with the new bill. Can you confirm that for me?
Sam Halverson.
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, there has been no opposition to this bill brought to me. And actually, this is the language that passed the Senate last year unanimously. And other than this little technical change that we brought from the State Patrol, it was all language that everybody was fine with at the end. And there were numerous changes made along the way last year. But this is what passed the Senate unanimously and what was coming to the House floor had we not.
Looks like we have, Madam Chair, another testifier may perhaps answer that. Thank you, Representative Halverson.
Thanks, Representative.
Good afternoon,
yes,
Madam Chair.
Would you please give us your name for the record? And
sure. My name is Tom Kelleher. I represent the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. We originally did have some concerns with the bill as originally proposed at the beginning of last session. Through discussions with Representative Halverson and the other body, the phrase that we had concerns with, which was the description of children crossing the road to get to the bus stop, we thought that that would be very limiting, considering we would end up having to have buses coming from the right and then the left, because the kids won't be prohibited from crossing the road. And as was stated, this particular neighborhood is very unique. It's on a divided four-lane road, next to a park, next to a public works building, down a single lane road. And we couldn't get a big yellow school bus down in there to turn around or to go down the neighborhood road and then back up. It's not safe to back up a big yellow school bus. So the solution was, and I talked to the transportation director about 10 days ago, and what they're doing is they're just taking a type 3 vehicle or a shorter yellow bus into the neighborhood to pick up the children. So the situation, Representative Howerson's case, no longer exists. Although I did see this morning coming to the Capitol a big yellow school bus in the right-hand turn lane, yellow lights came on, then the stop arm and the red lights came on. So there are situations, they're not very prevalent, but they do occur all across the state. Some school districts prohibit it, other school districts allow it and want it, for cost and safety reasons.
Right, so
and so we don't oppose the bill. And we do like the bill as amended by Representative McDonald, because that had been a problem that we wanted fixed.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Kelleher.
Thank you.
All right. Representative McDonald? I'm sorry, Representative Petersburg? Did you have a point?
I was just going to say, in regards to the question about how do you determine where and what you turn around, that is probably what keeps transportation directors up at night, trying to figure out all of these rules and options that they have. And the way I see this bill now is that it gives one more option for the school district to use, and so I think it's very valuable in that regard in order to give them that option to determine what is the best way and safest way to handle getting children back and forth to school, because that is their job and what they do. So thank you for bringing this bill.
And Representative Barr, did you have a question?
I'm going to pass this. It was answered.
Okay, very good. All right. We have Representative Mason.
I just was going to try to get clarification on what Representative Kosnick was saying. I'm sorry. The fact that I think he was trying to say the bus should be making a right turn lane, but I think the last testifier clarified that.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? Okay, seeing none, then we'll proceed to the vote. And I will move that the House File 455 be referred to the General Register as amended. House File 455 as amended. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is moved. It passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. And next up, do you want to take the gavel? I think I will do this up here. So.
All right, committee members, we will next hear House File 204, Chair Rumbach's bill. Would you like to move your bill, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'll move House File 204, and I believe it refers to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Chair Rumbach has an author's amendment labeled A5 to get the bill in the shape that she wishes. Chair Rumbach, please move your amendment before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I will move the A5 amendment. And I'll find it here. And what the amendment does is to just add some greater specificity and clarity to what we're looking for in this study.
Any discussion on the A5 amendment? The A5 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. Any discussion? Any questions? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
The motion prevails and the amendment is now adopted. Oh, I'm sorry. Any nay? Anybody opposed? Say nay. All right, hearing none, the motion is adopted. Please proceed with the testimony for the bill.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my bill addresses an issue that kind of surfaced 2 years ago. Because there was much discussion at that point about, of course, more funding for transportation. And in the newsletter of that year, January 2015, the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence asked the question, and I think you have that in your packets.
Chair Rumbach, I believe we do.
Okay. Yes. So the question is, why is the Minnesota's highway construction cost inflation rate so much higher than the nation's and the national average? And it was a very thorough article with a lot of questions raised, a lot of possible answers to that question. But there was no conclusion. And as I asked folks around the Capitol what might be the answer, there wasn't one. And to me, it's central to, you know, the thing we talk about every day in transportation finance. We need to get to the bottom of it. I think it's just one of those, as we are, you know, required to be the responsible party in terms of fiscal analysis and fiscal prudence, we need to know that answer. We want to do our roads right. We know, in fact, there was a study, in an OLA study in 1990 that, if I remember right, concluded that, yes, Minnesota roads are wonderfully built, but perhaps they're being overbuilt. I mean, so maybe that's part of the answer. But, you know, what are we doing with the materials cost? What are we doing with cost management strategies as projects are being built and so on? So I've asked Mark Haveman to come and testify to my bill, and Mark Haveman is the executive director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. Now, if you're not familiar with that name, the organization did change their name 5 years ago, I believe it was. Had been for 75 years the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, not a partisan group at all, but a research group and analysis group that has served the legislature for all those years with incredible analysis, testimony on taxes and the economy here in Minnesota. So, and I have been, you know, an avid, I should say, reader of their newsletters over the years. So it's valuable information, and I wanted the folks there at the center to help in terms of getting to the bottom, getting to the answers to the questions that they raised in their newsletter. So I'm going to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Haveman, and perhaps you can help us out and give us a little bit more insight or where we should be going from here.
Mr. Haveman, welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mark Haveman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. As Representative Rumbeck noted, we are a 90-year-old organization founded on the idea of citizen oversight being the cornerstone of responsible self-government. And as a result, it's really important for citizens to not just understand how government works and how we spend our money, but also why government programs cost what they do, which is why studies like was being recommended here in House File 204 are oftentimes very useful things to do across all areas of government. As Representative Rumbeck said, a couple of years ago we were doing some work on transportation finance and came across this oddity of very different rates of highway cost inflation. As you see in the materials that was presented to you, from 2014, the Federal Highway Administration National Highway Construction Cost Index grew at an annualized rate of 0.9%. And over that same period, Minnesota Highway Cost Construction Index grew at an annualized rate of about 5.7%. That is a obviously substantial difference. And there are a couple of possible explanations for that, and frankly, both of them are likely to contribute to this issue in some way. First of all, obviously, there may be just simple, significant supply and demand differences here in the state of Minnesota versus elsewhere across the country, also influenced by potential state-specific factors like climate, materials and engineering mandates and specifications. A number of state-specific things may cause this discrepancy. When we dug a little deeper, we also noticed that there's also a methodological difference. The federal government has moved away from a cost index based on fixed prices to something that they believe is more responsive to changes in construction purchases and their weighting over time, so to accommodate more of the innovation that does exist in highway construction and how different inputs may be weighted differently over time. The indexes are not necessarily better or worse, they're just different. So both those things may be at play here and likely are at play here, but regardless of what the difference actually is, I think it matters to take a closer look at it for a couple of reasons. If the difference is based mostly on having Minnesota having a more challenging cost environment, then I think a breakdown of the reasons why that exists is important and necessary, so we can have a better understanding of what factors can be controlled and what factors can't be controlled through state action in the pursuit of greater efficiency in transportation spending. On the other hand, if most of the difference is based on sort of these technical measurement results with respect to how inflation is measured, then I think a closer look at the inflationary estimates used to determine how much revenue we need in the future to meet transportation needs is warranted. The impact of an inflation rate, especially on the types of time frames we're talking about here and the types of dollars that we talk about here are very substantial. An Accenture study examined a couple of years ago what a 2.5% inflation factor would, how that would impact the state's transportation estimate for a world-class transportation infrastructure, and the impact was $4.5 billion over 20 years. So in short, the current transportation debate, we believe, justifiably so, is focusing a lot on money. It's focusing a lot on where that money should come from, both critical issues. But we hope that issues that are contained in this proposed study don't get lost in between the cracks, because we believe that deserves to be a very important part of our transportation finance policy debate going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Haberman. Is there any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Unless you're asking for the public.
Well, you or both, yes.
Okay.
Testifiers in the audience, yeah, I see Mr. Bentley Graves. Anybody else? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with any testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm the Director of Healthcare and Transportation Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll keep my remarks brief. I just, first of all, wanted to thank Representative Runbeck for bringing this forward, and thank Mr. Haberman for his discussion of the importance of this topic. Mr. Haberman referenced a study done by Accenture a couple of years ago. That was a study that was commissioned by the Chamber and a number of other business organizations who were interested in this very same question about generally, you know, what is it that goes into the various long-term funding needs estimates that the department's put together over the last couple of years? You know, what kind of dials do they turn to kind of generate those numbers, and what inputs are factored in? And as Mr. Haberman noted, one of the important inputs is inflation. There's kind of two big dials that the department, in making these estimates, can kind of turn one way or another to dial up or dial down the needs number. One of them is inflation, and the other relates to the long-term targets as far as bridge and pavement condition goes. But the inflation piece, as was noted, there seems to be some discrepancies in how Minnesota tracks and calculates inflation with regard to building roads and what the long-term need for funding is in that regard. And so it's something that was flagged in the Accenture report. It's something that we've been trying to kind of flag with policymakers and legislators over the last couple of years as this debate has kind of carried on. There's no question that, I think from our perspective anyway, that there is a need for additional investment. But we also want to make sure that we have a good handle on what's driving that need for investment. And if there are things, as was noted through this sort of study, that can be identified that we can wrestle with and can kind of bring more under control to help make sure that we can afford the investments over the long term, that obviously is certainly helpful. And if there aren't, then maybe there are other aspects of the long-term build program that we can look at to ensure that, again, we have the resources necessary. So I just want to take a moment to thank Representative Runbeck for bringing this forward. This is something that we strongly support. It's something that we've been working on for a number of years as well. And happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Bentley. Representative Bernardi has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Mr. Chair. Get used to calling Chair Runbeck, Madam.
That
was a compliment, I guess.
Yeah, we're good.
Okay, so thank you for this information, and I was able to read through it during committee today. This was helpful to put a framework around this. And I appreciate trying to drill down on this and find things that will help us as we figure out what kind of resources we need. One of the questions I have is, when this index is talking about construction cost, is it referring to just new construction, or does it include the mill and overlays and all the prevented things that happen on a roadway during its life cycle cost? And I'm not I'm asking that question because I want to gain a better understanding of this index and put in the frame of my framework is I want to know how applicable this is to MnDOT's program, this index, because most of MnDOT's program is the preventative maintenance work, not all the new reconstruction stuff. And so I would like to find out what that includes in the index.
Chair Rombach?
Representative Bernardi, I'm going to assume it's all of it because it, you know, we didn't get any differentiation as this was looked at the, and you know, whether USDOT and MnDOT differentiate some of their cost aspects, the materials are, you know, very likely many of them the same. A lot of the public construction equipment is going to be the same. So I'm just going to assume it is the same. It's okay. one type of, you know, it's building roads.
Okay, thank you, Madam
Chair. Representative Rombach?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my other question, and if anyone be, Madam Chair, if anybody thinks that's different in the audience, that would be helpful to know. And then my other question that I wanted to ask about, what can MnDOT share with us what their percentage of inflation that they're using for their 20-year projections? Is it the 5.7% that the Minnesota number is, or is it a different number?
Does somebody from the department want to answer Chair or Representative Bernardi's question?
Madam Chair? The analysis and in the article, I mean, it is what it is saying is that we are using a 5.7% as the average inflation rate. Mr. Haberman,
feel free to answer the question. Reintroduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure, Mr. Chairman Mark Haven, Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. To my recollection, and I yield to the Department of Transportation on this, the number that I believe was used for their projection going forward was 5%. I could be wrong. I yield to the department's plan itself, and those who know that better than I.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay.
Not seeing anybody coming forward from the department. Representative Bernardi, did you have a follow-up?
I can talk about my amendments later, but I'm getting more information on this meeting that's very helpful, Mr. Chair.
Great. Representative Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this question would be for Mr. Halverson. Is it Halverson?
Haveman.
One more time?
Haveman.
Thank you. And again, I find this this very constructive in having this conversation and providing for a bill that could further study this. But in taking a look at some of the materials that were provided here and taking a quick look at the U.S. Department of Transportation's website, this National Highway Construction Cost Index, which is what we're referring to, and that's the kind of the eye-popping statistic shown at the top of the article, is intended to replace the Federal Highway Administration Bid Price Index. Can you speak to this previous metric in terms of how Minnesota was compared nationally versus this new indices?
Mr. Haveman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it is my understanding that the federal government switched out in 2003 from the bid price index, and it's my understanding that the index that was used before very much mirrored the same methodology that the current that the Department of Transportation currently employs, and that in 2000 a fixed price index, and what transpired in 2003, they made the decision that this alternative method does a better job of adjusting for how transportation inputs, relative inputs, can change over time in the construction of transportation infrastructure.
Representative Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it to be true as well. And again, just referring to the U.S. Department of Transportation website, I wouldn't necessarily agree that they're saying it's better than. It does even reference on the main page that for historical purposes, this bid price index should still be utilized to provide a form of context. So not fully doing away with it, viewing it as a means in which to compare, and I guess that would be information that I'd like to see, too, in terms of, obviously,
NDOT projects are bid out to the low bid. We have a procurement process in which those are properly vetted. That type of data, I think, still is pertinent and relevant to this type of study.
Thank you. Anybody else have any questions on the committee? Okay, I see a few amendments here to House File 204. Would anybody like to offer amendments to the bill?
Mr. Chair, they were ones that I had submitted, and I just want to...
Representative Bernardi.
Right, so if we just... Can I talk about the amendments first, and then... Okay, can I just talk about them first?
We'd like to talk about them.
Okay,
yes,
thank you.
Sounds good.
So it was very helpful today and to know more about this bill, and I just wanted to get, through my amendments, I wanted to get clarification if it includes the full cost of the roadway when you're doing mill and overlays and all those sorts of things, that it wasn't just the new construction cost. So that was important to me. And then the other bill that I'm trying to get at is, and I don't think it's appropriate, or amendment, it's not, I don't think it's appropriate for this bill because I see now what Representative Chair Runbeck is trying to get after. But what I'm interested in is also starting collecting the data of what we actually spend from local governments on our trunk highway system, because it might, because of cost participation and other things, we are spending more than what oftentimes we're reporting through the MnDOT expenditures. And so that was what I was trying to get at, and I don't think this is a vehicle for doing that. And so I'm going to withdraw those amendments.
Okay. So none of your previous amendments? Or,
no, right.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Appreciate it. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Chair Runbeck, would you like to have closing comments?
Just say thanks to the committee for hearing the bill. I too think it's an essential question. I don't know if we'll have answers, you know, before we have to put our commitment to the finance bill this year. But I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to reach some important analyses and be able to address some future spending bills. So
great.
Thanks for your support.
I will renew Chair Rumbeck's motion that House File 204 will be referred to, as amended, to the Committee on Transportation Finance. Those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion does prevail. All right, members, that concludes our agenda for today. Chair Rumbeck, did you have any other comments for the committee? Okay, that concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, February 15th. We are adjourned.